If you've ever had a vigorous or even heated conversation with someone about a work of art, you know, you love it, they hate it, they're wrong, or, you know, that sort of thing, then please listen. There are a great many philosophical questions swirling around the world of art. What makes a piece good? Is that an objective or a subjective thing? And why do we like what we like? Well, the next guest here on the Hub on Art offers some insights into how these questions might be answered. Ellen Winner is a professor of psychology at Boston College. She's a researcher at Harvard University, and she's written a book called How Art Works, A Psychological Exploration. From Boston, Ellen Winner.
Thank you for having me.
And you research the psychology of arts, so I know it's a big question, but why do we like what we like?
Yes, that is a huge question. There's a lot of debate about why we like what we like. Some people want to argue that there are objective standards of aesthetic goodness, and people are able to recognize what's good and what's bad because it's just clear. It's clear as facts. But most people don't agree with that. And if you ask people what they like, you find huge individual differences. If you ask people whether they believe that aesthetic judgments have any objective basis, they will say mostly it's all subjective. It's just a matter of opinion. I can think Shakespeare is great, and you can think Dan Brown is greater than Shakespeare, and we're both equally right, and there's no way to disprove it. And it's odd that most people hold that view and yet argue fiercely with other people who disagree with them. And I think that the evidence really lies in favor of the view that we don't really know why we like what we like, and it is a subjective opinion. There is some evidence that we like what we are familiar with, even if we don't know we're familiar with it.
Ellen, what's going on in our brains when we do make a judgment on a particular piece of art?
Well, I don't really believe that brain research tells us that much about why we like what we like. We do know, however, that when people feel extremely moved by visual art, an area of the brain called the default mode network is activated, and that area is known to be associated with introspection, which has led the researchers who did this study to say that when we look at art that moves us, it causes us to look inside ourselves and think introspectively, which, if true, would be very interesting. We just need more research on that.
Yes. Now, Ellen, there's I'm sure you know this painting, Blue Poles, by Jackson Pollock. It's a painting which is owned by the Australian government and bought in the 1970s at great expense. It's displayed in the National Gallery of Australia in Canberra. And it was very controversial. And people at the time thought, you know, why are we spending all this money on this completely abstract painting? But now, because there was such an argument about it in the 70s, and that has continued on for decades, but gradually people have indeed become more familiar with this work. And now I would say it's probably one of the most viewed and most loved paintings in our collection. So is that then an example of how familiarity can really breed love in that kind of way?
Familiarity, as well as learning that Pollock is quote unquote great. You know, when Pollock first started painting, people ridiculed it. And it was only after it was discovered that he put a huge amount of effort and intentionality into just how he made his drips. And he thought very carefully ahead of time about what kinds of patterns he wanted to create. It was only after people recognized the great effort that went into it that he began to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
So there is a kind of bias that if you try really hard at something and you spend a lot of time at it, that makes the art better. So I would say that we've come to see Pollock as very effortful and intentional. I would also say something else, and that is that there is this view that abstract art is a fraud, and my kid could have done that, and anybody could do this, and anybody could make a Pollock. But actually, in my lab, the Arts and Mind Lab, we have shown over and over again in a series of studies that if you pair an abstract work of art by a quote-unquote great abstract expressionist, such as Pollock, with a work by a child or an animal, such as an elephant or a monkey, because those are animals that have been given paintbrushes. If you pair these two things together and you create your pairs carefully so that they look superficially similar, and that's actually quite easy to do, people can tell the difference. They can tell which one is by the artist. If you ask which one is better, they can tell you. If you ask children, they can distinguish them. If you ask a computer program, they can distinguish them. If you look at people's eye gaze, you see that people gaze longer at the ones by the professionals. So it is not the case that abstract art is just anything that anybody could do. That is a myth, and we actually see a lot more in abstract art than the ordinary person thinks that they see.
And do you know more detail about why that happens? Why, for instance, would we look, why do we gaze at a Picasso more than a painting by a pig who's called Pigcasso, which is an actual thing?
Okay, well, let's not use Picasso because he's representational, and okay. I'm actually talking here about this research pertains to purely abstract expressionist art. But we do know why people look longer at the abstract expressionist art by professionals, and that is they perceive greater intentionality in it.
And how do we perceive that?
How do we perceive intentionality? Well, the only thing I can say to that is that if something is perceived to have more structure, it is perceived to have more intentionality. But I can't get more specific than that. It's a kind of a global, holistic judgment people make, and it's kind of mysterious that people are able to look at a bunch of scribbles and dots and drips and blobs and perceive intentionality in it. We value effort, and we believe that more effort makes something better.
Yes.
That's not always true, but people have that bias.
Yes, and Ellen, I see that on a regular basis with children. You know, I teach children music, and I really see the difference in their response when they are listening to something that has had a lot of effort put into it. It's a massive difference.
So that's, you mean they respect the effort and realize that it's better?
Absolutely.
You can prime people either way, though. If you tell people great art takes effort, you get this kind of response. But if you prime another group of people saying great art takes talent, then you can actually get people to think that a work of art done very quickly is a better work of art than one labored over.
Yes. Well, then that I guess that's a whole different thing that we could talk about is there such a thing as talent or is it simply hard work?
Well, I'd be happy to talk about that if you'd like me to.
Oh, let's talk about it. Why not? Okay, so Ellen, do you believe that there's such a thing as genius in art?
Yes, I do. And it's a politically incorrect view because of the claim that all you need is 10,000 hours to become great. I dispute that because if you look at very young children who are prodigies in an area, whether it's music, math, chess, drawing, you see early signs of talent long before they've done any practicing, long before they've had any training. So, and then if you look at how these people develop, how these children develop, they make such rapid progress and they need so little adult scaffolding that it is just simply, to me, nonsensical to say that every child is the same and those who work harder reach higher levels. Of course, hard work is important in any kind of achievement, but it simply is not, it's necessary. It simply is not sufficient. And the other thing is, children who are talented have what I call a rage to master. It's a passion, and you can't pull them away from doing what they are good at. I have studied prodigies in drawing who will not stop drawing. They draw in school. They draw at breakfast. They're obsessed with it. And where does that passion come from? That's something that's innate and is connected to having high talent. It's not something you just cannot take an ordinary child and make them spend 40 hours of work a week drawing or practicing the piano. They will rebel.
Yes.
You know, not all prodigies go on in the area in which they're good at.
Yeah.
Most prodigies do until they get to adolescence, and then they reach a real crisis because it becomes clear to them that they have to be more than expert. They have to do something new if they're going to really make it. So the transition from being a prodigy to being a creator, that's a very difficult bridge to cross. There are many, many prodigies who are applauded as five-year-olds and totally forgotten as adults because they're doing something that's technically proficient, but they're not doing anything that's radically new. So they're really not creators.
Mm. How do we study something that one could say is purely qualitative not quantitative.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. How do we study art in the laboratory?
Yes.
Well, I believe that psychology is about studying what's most important in human beings, and you cannot leave the arts out. So you can study all kinds of things in the laboratory, and it's, of course, not going to be exactly. You always give something up when you study something in the laboratory. You always have to use some kind of, you always have to operationalize your measures. You always have to reduce things somewhat. That's just the nature of science. But I don't believe that if you analyze people's responses to art, that you're ruining it or that you can't capture it. I believe that science can capture something of how people respond to art, how people reason about art, what people hear or see in art. You can do that in the scientific laboratory. You just have to apply scientific principles to it. You want to use real art, and you want to treat everybody the same, and you want to make sure that your questions are open-ended so you don't lead the witness. You want to give people time to show what they really believe.
Yeah.
But I don't believe there's any reason we cannot do science about people's response to art. That doesn't mean that science can answer all questions about art, but I think it can answer some very interesting ones.
Yeah. Ellen, it has been completely fascinating speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ellen Winner, Professor of Psychology at Boston College, and her book is called How Art Works, A Psychological Exploration, and that's published by Oxford University Press. So what do you think? Is there such a thing as talent?